You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. There are a lot of things to blame for the housing affordability crisis in the Bay Area. We talk about a shortage of housing. We talk about predatory landlords and property flippers. We talk about why we have a for-profit housing system at all. In his new book, longtime San Francisco housing activist Randy Shaw implicates a particular group who've profited from this affordability crisis. That's urban homeowners. The book is called Generation Priced Out: Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? Randy's research was based in New York, Seattle, Denver, Austin, LA, and here in San Francisco, where he runs the Tenderloin Housing Clinic and the news site beyondcron.org. KLW's economy reporter Liza Veal spoke to Shaw about how he sees the role of homeowners in the story of urban unaffordability.
People might be surprised to learn that cities like San Francisco, which are very seen as very pro-tenant, over half the available residential land, you cannot build a new apartment building. When you can't build apartments in all these neighborhoods, they become exclusive, primarily white enclaves, and that's not productive for a city that publicly claims to support inclusion and diversity, but its land use policies promote elitism and lack of diversity.
And how have homeowners kind of been a part of making those circumstances?
Well, the homeowners, first, they have political influence with elected officials through district elections in San Francisco. And also, very critically, when it comes to these land use hearings that occur at 2 o'clock on Thursday at the Planning Commission, who can go to a hearing? It's often the homeowners turn out in force, and the officials feel, well, gee, we're hearing from the community, but actually they're hearing from a sliver. And as I discuss in the book, in city after city, homeowner associations are considered demographically unrepresentative, even their own neighborhood. They're wider and more homeowner-based than the rest of their neighborhood.
Homeowners object to new apartments because they're worried about preserving the character. Is there more, like, kind of financial stake that they have?
Well, I mean, they're making great profits by restricting supply, but I think they would say, I mean, they don't want apartments in their neighborhood. They want fewer people. They feel like there's more parking spots. I mean, meanwhile, they're exporting the housing problem to suburban locales, which lead to great traffic problems and greenhouse gas emissions from these long commutes we have in the Bay Area. So I think they have this out of sight, out of mind, like, okay, we're going to keep our neighborhood pristine and keep no cars on the street. And the fact that 120,000 people are commuting from Sacramento to the Bay Area every day, we don't see that, so we're going to make believe it doesn't exist. It's hard to see. If we were creating a policy right now in San Francisco, there is no way in the world city government or any supervisor would say, we should take half the city and only let homeowners live there. There's just no way that would be the case. Same thing with Oakland, the fact that you have Rock Ridge and Temescal and these areas that are high transit corridors that have a 30-foot height limit. Like, why?
Okay, so you describe in the book some real ways in which renters' interests are at odds with the interests of homeowners. When we prioritize renters' interests, it entails undermining the value of homes. And
I would challenge that, though. I think every study has shown that even affordable housing in homeowner areas does not reduce home values. No, it doesn't reduce the value of homes. I mean, that's what's so unfair about it, is that the notion that if you have, like it's just happened in San Jose, housing for teachers, 4,000 people signed petitions saying it's going to reduce our property values, totally false.
But if we do overall build enough housing supply to make housing, the value of housing go down, then housing as an investment will be less profitable.
Well, right now, the last 6 years, homeowners in San Francisco made $1 million profit. So, I mean, the profits have been astronomical, far beyond. Most people don't buy a house for their own private house. They buy it because they like a residence, they want security. They're not trying to get $60,000 a year in equity going up every year.
Yeah, that's a real scenario. But there's also, I mean, it is one of the important ways that people in this country secure their economic futures. It's an investment that you can cash in retirement. It's a way to bring your children into a different economic bracket than you were in. It's an advantage that is not just for very, very rich people.
Are you saying that, yeah, the boomer homeowners who bought in the 80s obviously didn't pay a lot for their houses and they've made a profit? Are you saying that they should continue to make humongous profits at the expense of a new generation who can't afford to live in the city? I guess I wouldn't agree with you on that.
No, I wouldn't either, but I'm just wondering if there are, you know, if there's a certain tension that you do have to grapple with between lower income homeowners who are betting on that.
I think that's a myth of the lower income homeowner, and I don't think it's really a myth.
I mean, in Oakland and Richmond, there are lower income.
Well, I'm not talking about Richmond in my book, but I think the question is, what if you want to live in, if you're a teacher, and you teach in San Francisco, should you have to live in Richmond? because you can't afford San Francisco. I think San Francisco should provide you opportunities. That's what I believe. That's what the book argues.
So you're saying you don't worry about how any of these things could come at the expense of this.
I don't think it's at the expense. I don't think maximizing profits of homeowners should be a social goal when you mean excluding teachers, nurses, firefighters, and other working people from living in a city.
Okay, so you have a lot of respect for some of these activists that are trying to, the predominantly millennial activists that are trying to change this. People refer to them as YIMBYs sometimes, which stands for Yes in My Backyard. And they're pushing for upzoning neighborhoods or legalizing apartments. You say they're talented. What are they doing right? What kinds of things do you think they're doing wrong in your mind?
Well, I think they're turning out. In these cities like Cupertino, which never allowed any tech facilities, they didn't have any housing connected to it, and that helped really hurt San Francisco. They go out to Cupertino, the YIMBYs, and they've been very good at getting housing approved there. I think that the legalizing apartments campaign is really critical because I think it highlights the key issue. Because when you use the word upzoning, no one really is quite clear what it means. They think, oh, wait, you're going to put high rises in the west side of San Francisco? Or you're going to put high rises in Rock Ridges? No, we can keep the same height, but instead of a mansion, you can build a fourplex. And that's really the key issue that I don't think people realize is that the Sunset is zoned 40 feet and you can build a mansion. A 40-foot tall mansion. You cannot build 4 units or 10 units. That makes no sense. And I think you're going to see the supervisors recognize that, and it makes it harder to vote against something when you say you want a mansion rather than a fourplex.
The critique that I hear against people that focus as their main priority, you know, density and promoting private development in cities is that these people can be sort of neglectful of some of the drawbacks, which are basically displacement.
I think that way too much is made out of there's a whole universe of people who support housing. Many of them, some people don't have the same views as I do on this issue. They oppose rent control. You obviously have to have rent control. But I think across the board that what the main thrust is going on is saying we have to legalize apartments in single-family home neighborhoods or we're never going to get out of this housing crisis. I think if you look, and I write in the book about the Mission District, which is been seen like ground zero in the gentrification wars, one of the reasons so much housing, multi-unit buildings get proposed for the Mission is they can't build in half the city. So you're limiting where you can build to the Mission and Soma and Tenderloin neighborhoods because vast stretches of the city you can't build apartments. If we change that, it would be less displacement.
Okay, so last I wanted to ask you about, just in light of these fires, how housing can or must play a role in fighting climate change and also preparing the state for
it. This is the whole issue that unlike in Seattle and in others and other cities, Portland, there's a high environmental consciousness realizing we have to have infill housing. Otherwise, we have sprawl, which is the worst form for greenhouse gases. But in places like Berkeley, you have homeowners who drive a Prius, recycle, maybe have solar panels on their roof, but then prevent any apartments being built in their neighborhood, consigning a whole group of people who could be living in Berkeley to Sacramento and making hour-long commutes. The greenhouse gases created by those 120,000 commuters coming from Sacramento to the Bay Area every day is humongous, and that's really the problem.
That was Randy Shaw speaking with Liza Veal about his new book, Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? You can find more from Shaw at beyondcron.org, and you can reach Liza at economy@klw.org.